Welcome to Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia, and my co-host, Dr. Danielle Schurer of the Medical University of South Carolina, is on the line. This week's conversation centers on whether subclinical atrial fibrillation can point to a greater risk of stroke. It's known that clinical AFib does, but does the risk extend to the less obvious subclinical variety? And by the way, if it's subclinical, how do you find it clinically, and what do you do about it then? Our guest is Dr. Stuart Connolly, a co-author of an international study of the question that was published this week in the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Connolly and the ASSERT investigators recruited some 2,600 patients who just received an implanted pacemaker or cardioverter defibrillator. After 3 months, the devices were interrogated, and the patients who showed subclinical atrial fibrillation in that period, about 10% of the total, were noted. The entire group was then followed for about 2.5 years. During follow-up, ischemic stroke or systemic thromboembolism was more than twice as frequent among the group initially showing subclinical AFib as those without. Dr. Connolly is a professor of medicine at McMaster University, where he is director of the Division of Cardiology in the Department of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Connolly, to Clinical Conversations.
Hello.
My first question, Dr. Connolly, is how did your study differ from others in the area, and had clinicians dismissed the possibility that subclinical AFib could be a sign of increased stroke risk?
Well, I think that subclinical atrial fibrillation is not a topic that is receiving a whole lot of attention, partly because we haven't had very good tools for measuring it. By definition, this is atrial fibrillation that patients have, but they don't feel it, and they're not having it very often, so it's not getting picked up on routine ECGs and the like. The purpose of our study was to use the opportunity that is available from pacemakers in a select population to look at this question, because pacemakers are able to detect subclinical atrial fibrillation, something that we've known for about 10 years. The goal of our study was to assess prospectively and very carefully how common this was in patients who did not have other forms of atrial fibrillation, so a non-atrial fib population, and to see how common it was, and then to see whether or not it increased the risk of stroke.
Now, previous studies, had there been any studies using this tactic, or was yours the first to do this?
Ours was the first sort of formal, carefully done study that did this in patients who did not have atrial fibrillation. Other studies have looked and noted episodes of atrial fibrillation, but they weren't specifically focusing on the ones that were subclinical. They were noting that there's lots of atrial fibrillation on the pacemakers, some of which is in patients with atrial fibrillation and some not. So ours was the first sort of large prospective cohort study in non-AFib patients to show that this was both very common. We saw it in close to half the patients if we monitored for long enough, and that more importantly, when we saw it, especially if we saw it in the first 3 months, we saw that there was quite a sharp increase in the risk of stroke. Which makes sense because it is obviously closely related to the usual forms of atrial fibrillation, but no one had ever really carefully demonstrated that before.
And you calculated that the population attributable risk of stroke or embolism associated with the subclinical variety was about 13% in the group that you studied, and that's a lot of events. Do you think you've identified a major avoidable risk factor here?
That may be going a little bit beyond our data.
Uh-huh.
But you're absolutely right. The attributable risk for stroke from the subclinical atrial fibrillation in our study was 13%. We know that the attributable risk for stroke from clinical atrial fibrillation in the Framingham trial was 16%. So it looks like this represents almost as big a burden of stroke potentially as clinical atrial fibrillation. Now that seems like a big jump, and it certainly there's quite a lot of work to be done still to show that this is true. And the main reason that the work needs to be done is that we've studied pacemaker patients, Mm-hmm. The real question, or one of the big questions, is would this also be true in patients who are like the pacemaker population, say older with hypertension, mm-hmm. perhaps diabetes, but who don't have a pacemaker? And then that's a question for which we don't have an answer. My personal guess is that we will see subclinical atrial fibrillation if we can figure out how to look for it mm-hmm. in these other populations of patients. And, you know, sort of turning it around and saying, well, how many strokes out there are not explained by severe vascular disease in mm-hmm. the carotid arteries or by known atrial fibrillation? And actually, it's about 25%. So the neurologists tell us that 25% of the strokes they see are what they call cryptogenic, mm-hmm. which means unknown cause. Some of those, if you monitor the patients closely after the stroke, you will turn up atrial fibrillation, but mm-hmm. we don't have good monitoring techniques.
So it is incredibly unfortunate that, you know, obviously the people with subclinical AFib don't know they have it. And so in that same vein, I'm sort of wondering, should we be more aggressively looking for it in those patients with risk factors without pacemakers?
Well, I think that's one of the next research, one of the nice things about a good study is that it opens up a whole lot of other questions to explore. Mm-hmm. So we think that's one of the next big questions is to say, well, if we monitored the non-device older patients who have hypertension, yeah. diabetes, for example, would we find subclinical atrial fibrillation? And we're, in fact, planning a study to do that, and we're going to use a tool that's actually now available for helping us learn that, and it's called the implantable loop recorder.
Mm-hmm.
These devices have actually been around for quite a long time, and they're helpful for diagnosing unexplained causes of fainting or syncope.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the companies that make them, particularly St. Jude Medicine, and also Medtronic, have developed software that helps us diagnose subclinical atrial fibrillation as well from these little loop recorders that just get stuck underneath the skin, and patients can have them for up to a couple of years. So we're hoping that technology will help us to see if subclinical atrial fibrillation is common in the general population, and more importantly, in which patients is it quite common?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't expect it to be very common. We're saying, well, maybe if we choose the patients to be high risk, we might see it in 10 or 12%.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That would still be pretty common, but mm-hmm. it turns out to be an important risk factor for stroke.
And then obviously the other future direction for research that you allude to in your discussion section is anticoagulant therapy for subclinical AFib, and you know, who should you do it in, and is it the same clinical, you know, CHAD scoring that should determine whether or not you do aspirin versus anticoagulant versus nothing?
Yeah, that's a very real present problem, because having, you know, published a paper now that indicates that there's quite an increased risk of stroke in pacemaker patients who have these episodes showing up.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do when you see it? And,
mm-hmm.
and this is not a rare occurrence. I mean, if you work in a pacemaker clinic, you're going to see these types of patients almost every day.
Right.
And many of them will not be on anticoagulation. Some small surveys that we've done locally here suggest that only about 25 to 40% of these patients will be anticoagulated. So when you see this, what do you do? Do you anticoagulate them?
Right.
Do you assume that it's just like atrial fibrillation and they would benefit from warfarin or dabigatran? Or do you say, well, this really is not the same as clinical atrial fibrillation.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know whether it has the same risk of stroke. We don't know whether the same risk-benefit ratios and profiles fit for these patients as they do for clinical AFib.
Right.
Maybe we should be more cautious in jumping in and anticoagulating. So there's no real guidance for physicians right now. The guidelines have basically been blind to this issue up until now. So
mm-hmm.
We think a clinical trial would be, well, whether it's needed or whether it would, there's no doubt it would be helpful, and it would certainly heighten interest in this area and focus on this fairly substantial number of patients.
Mm-hmm.
But whether it's actually going to get done or not, another question. It's obviously not an easy sort of clinical trial to do.
Sure. And just on a personal note, what would you do tomorrow if you're in your pacemaker clinic and you find someone with subclinical AFib and they're not on aspirin or an anticoagulant, what kind of discussion would you have?
Well, the first thing is, of course, is to think about this individual patient. So, what are the other risk factors for stroke? What's the CHAD score?
Right.
CHAD's VAS score. Has he had a prior stroke, for example?
That's
number one. Number two is, of course, what's his bleeding risk?
What's the risk?
Bleeding risk. Well, then anticoagulation is probably not a very good idea.
That's right.
And having done that, then the question is, well, what does the atrial fibrillation look like? I mean, is it just once you've seen it in years of monitoring only lasting a few minutes, or is he having a lot of it and it's longer episodes, say up to several hours? And you know, I think that influences me and probably influences most physicians, although we don't have a whole lot of evidence that the duration of atrial fibrillation is important.
Right.
And we did set the cutoff in this study at only 6 minutes, which would suggest that short episodes may be important. But I would say that even though we set the cutoff at 6 minutes, most patients who had 6 minutes also had longer episodes as well.
So probably not that much different than the decision-making that is currently going on in many primary care offices where, just like you said, what's their risk of stroke and what's their risk of bleeding and making a decision, you know, based on risk and benefit.
That is probably the right thing to do. I mean, in the absence of a good clinical trial, risk-benefit ratios, as if the patient was atrial fibrillation, and then some thinking about, well, just how much atrial fibrillation is there, how long are the episodes?
Yeah.
I think that's good advice, Dr. Conley. Thanks for talking with us today.
Pleasure.
Great. Thanks so much.
That was our 141st edition. All earlier ones may be found at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from Journal Watch, an excellent way to keep current with clinical research whose implications affect your daily practice. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time for myself and Dr. Danielle Scherer. Thank you for listening.